Hello. Hello, everyone. Welcome to 505 and welcome to 2SER and Groove Scooters in Conversation at the Sydney Fringe Festival. My name is Peter Waller-Bryant, and with me tonight is an extraordinary person with a very extraordinary life. She's revolutionised crowdfunding for music globally, touched the hearts and minds of countless teenagers with her songwriting in the Dresden Dolls, and that is an audience who has grown up to love her solo career. Beyond all this, she's an artist who sets her own boundaries and defines her own style. Please don't excuse my language when I welcome to the stage Amanda fucking Palmer. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you
nice
for coming.
Club.
Now, I was 15 years old when the Dresden Dolls EP came out, and it felt like a perfect representation of me at the time. I'd like to start off by having you describe 15-year-old Amanda Palmer.
Well, you know, my own opinion of myself at 15... And then, and funny, because as I get older, I get to hear other people's perspectives on what they thought of me. My picture of myself was pretty warped, as I think is pretty usual for a teenager. I was really insecure and very confused and angry. You know, it's like a typical angry young person. And there's actually, journalists and stuff ask me all the time, like, did you ever have that one moment where, like, fill in the fucking blank, you know, you knew that you wanted to be a musician, or, you know, you finally felt comfortable on stage, or you know, you figured out, and I've never had any moments like that in my life, except once, and I never get asked that question.
What was that moment?
I was 13 or 14, and I literally decided to change my life deliberately. I had been sort of living in the shadow of my mean older sister, and shopping at the mall and buying clothes from the Gap and, like, matching my hair scrunchie to my socks, to my lip gloss and stuff, and being a very typical girl. I was weird, but I was trying desperately to fit in and be friends with the popular kids. And the night before eighth grade, so I would have been 14, I was going through one of my favorite rituals of all time, which was picking my outfit for the first day of school, which was always like I would spend the entire night like figuring out what to wear. And I had very few black clothes, but I sort of I put together this ensemble of, you know, I was trying everything out, and I put on all black. This is such a great story. I've never told it actually, and I looked at myself in the bathroom mirror, and I was like, "Fuck everybody." I'm dyeing all my clothes again and be like my sister. I'm no longer going to try and make friends. I'm just going to be a fucking punk. And I just like, and I was so happy. I was like, yes! Oh, thank God. And that was it. Like, I walked into junior high school the next day and everyone was like, what the fuck? Because I just went there immediately, like overnight. I was like, no, fuck all you. I don't want to be friends with you. I'm going to put on my Walkman. I'm going to be into music and art. And, you know, and I was already into music and art, but I hadn't defined myself so much as a freak. And it was so funny the way I just flipped that way and I never went back.
Did people treat you differently after that?
Yeah, well, the thing was, is I already had the personality of a weirdo. I was just trying to look normal. So the popular kids didn't really want to be friends with me because I was a spaz and too crazy and too strange or too porny or whatever I was as a kid. And I felt like finally my exterior matched my interior. And it was that thing, I think a lot of people realize that, like, around that age, that if they fly their freak flag, they're going to, like, find the other freaks who are the people who will be friends with them and that they actually have shit in common with. And it wards off the wrong people coming and talking to you, you know, the normal people who are fucking uninteresting. That's the way you think when you're 14, right? So, I mean, that probably gives you, that was me at 14, and then, you know, I decided, you know, I looked at punk and goth and, you know, my older brother and stuff who was kind of punk, and I just went in that vague direction, you know, dyed my hair and got pierced and, you know, tried to figure out cool music to listen to, which is interesting because that, you know, music at that time was, I was just looking up to all these people going, well, what are you listening to? What are you listening to? And because I wanted to be cool. But that led me down the path of finding music that actually, I didn't care if it was cool or not. I knew that I loved it. Mm. So it's interesting that way, the way people, you know, the way teenagers sort of find themselves. But I was, you know, I was antisocial. I was mean. You know, I was sort of mean to myself. I was mean to people around me. I was obsessed with honesty. Mm. So I was, you know, but I was honest to the point of being an asshole. I hadn't really learned how to temper it.
When did that change? You seem like a very nice person now.
My 20s were, a lot of my 20s were about balancing out my personality. I was, in high school and college especially, I look back and I was just all rough edges and confusion, and my thinking was very binary. It was like, you know, good and bad, and, you know, I felt very unsafe around people. It's so funny to think that I was antisocial. I was antisocial. I had a really hard time making friends, and didn't know how to be with people.
I don't think you could be more the polar opposite.
Well,
seemed that way anyway.
The funny thing is, in my mind, I was social. In my mind, I wanted to talk to everyone and be with everyone, but I didn't know how to do it. Mm. And I think, you know, I wasn't necessarily antisocial. I was just, I wanted everything to be intense all the time. I didn't want to have small talk with anyone. I didn't realize that you have to kind of, like, relationships need foreplay and stuff. I hadn't really figured any of this stuff out. I just wanted to immediately go there with everyone. And actually, if you look at what I have done with my life, all I've done is constructed a situation in which pretty much no one makes any small talk with me. And they, like, people come up to me at my shows and they're like, oh, I was just raped. And I'm like, oh, let's talk about it. It's great. Not the rape isn't great. That's terrible, but the fact that no one feels like they have to be superficial with me, people just immediately talk to me about true things. So maybe I've just constructed it to fit what I was, whereas when I was 18, everyone was like, so, how's school? And I was like, what the fuck? Fuck you. Let's talk about something interesting. Anyway.
You... From what I understand, you, even though you'd been writing music for a long time, it took until you were about 18 to actually perform it. What changed at that point?
Well, my relationship with my own songwriting fits in with all of that teenage angst and insecurity. I was terrified to play my music for anybody. And there's a couple of songs on the Dresden Dolls' first record Slide and Bad Habit, which I wrote when I was 15 and 17 or 18. And I think I still look at those and think they're great songs, and they've managed to hold up, you know, and didn't get recorded until years later when we finally recorded our first record, which is when I was like 25. But back then, I didn't have an audience. And I was too scared to have one. I was scared because the music meant too much to me and the songs were too personal to just like whip them out at a party and be like, hey, you guys, do you want to hear the song I wrote? Because it was too, the music was too, it was too scary. Mm. And I didn't play my first real show until I was 18. And I dumped it all out at once. I was at college, and I told myself, okay, you have to do this. You're a songwriter. You've written a bunch of songs. You have to play them for people. It's going to be scary as shit. You don't really even know anyone here, but I booked out a room with a piano in it at the college and put up flyers and was terrified. And just, you know, maybe 30 people came and sat. It was much like this. And I played about 50 minutes of music nonstop. I spoke very little. I actually recorded it. I have that recording. I should bust it out someday. I was really frightened. And like you can hear the applause on the recording. It's like,
oh man,
is she okay? Oh. Should we be worried? And that's kind of what I was expecting would happen. Like, it wasn't especially the shit I was writing then. It was, none of it was uplifting, funny, entertaining, or anything. It was just dark as shit and really personal. So how do you start with that? Yeah. Especially if you're kind of an antisocial kid. It's not like I had my, you know, group of artistic gothy friends when I was in high school. I didn't have any. So it's like, well, who do I play this for? My mom? No fucking way. So, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I just had to go through that experience. And then even then, you know, I played maybe a solo show once a year or twice a year. And it wasn't until I met Brian that I really got serious about it and comfortable enough to get in front of an audience and just do the work and do the job without feeling scared.
Mm. So you met Brian Viglione, your partner in the Dresden Dolls, at a Halloween party. What clicked between you? What was it?
He knew. You know when people talk about falling in love with each other, and sometimes it's one person like sees the other person at the bar and was like, I just knew. Brian saw me play at this party, and hearing him tell this story is great. But it was in, the party was in my house, in my art house collective, and I think I played 5 songs, including Slide and Bad Habit and a couple of others, to 60 or 70 people all whole, you know, in the attic of the house. And he just knew. He saw me play and was like, I love this music. She's totally crazy. I know exactly what to do if I play drums with her. And he came up to me and was like, I'm going to be your drummer. And I was like, okay, you're hired. It was that easy. And I had actually been, I was just starting to get my shit together around then. I was about 24, 25. And I had been street performing and stripping and doming and working as a barista and doing all sorts of crazy, weird, odd jobs and really enjoying my life, quite frankly, you know, doing crazy shit, hanging out with my friends in my new commune and drinking. I was like, this is great. I could do this all my life. But I should really get serious about the music stuff. I don't really know what to do. I don't, you know, I think I need a band. So I started looking for bassists and drummers. And pretty much anyone I met through my barista job or through friends of friends, anyone who was a drummer or a bassist, I got their phone number and I said, let's get together and play. I want to put a band together. And there were some really terrible musicians that I played with. And I didn't know what I was looking for, but I knew I would know when I found it. And, you know, I jammed with maybe five or six musicians before I played with Brian, but enough to sort of know what I didn't want. And Brian was in another band at the time called Asiento, as he calls his position in the band was indentured bassist, because he had moved to Boston to be in this band as the drummer, and then the bassist of the band quit, so the leader of the band put him on bass, and Brian was like, I want to play drums, and the guy was like, but you're really good at bass, just play bass, and Brian was like, and he was very unhappy in that situation at the time. And so we got together in the practice space of the band he was in late one night, like we snuck in. And I brought my keyboard. And the first time we played together, I said, well, so what do you want to do? How do you want to do this? And Brian said, well, just play. You know, this was like a week after that party. And Brian said, just play one of your songs. Play me something you're working on. Just play whatever. So I played him Sex Changes, which I had just written. And he listened and was like, okay, stop. Just go back to the beginning. I'm going to play along with you. And within like 2 minutes, I stopped and I looked at him and I was like, you're perfect. And he was like, I know, I told you. Shut the fuck up, play music. And that was, I think that one is up there as the best night of my life. Because I had never felt so understood by someone. And I just, oh God, I almost want to cry talking about it. Like I knew I'd found a soulmate. And so we played together for like 2 hours. I played him a bunch of songs. And we were so excited. We were like, we're a band, we're a band, we're a band. We kept shouting that. We're like, we're a band, we're a band. And then we finished playing and we went to Brian's apartment. His housemate, the indenturer, was out of town. And we ate an apple pie that he had stolen from his job at a bakery with our hands. And then went into Brian's little closet of a room, and he said, do you know Neutral Milk Hotel? And I said, no, I've never heard of them. Are they good? He said, okay, hold on. And he turned the lights in the room off, and we sat on his bed and listened to the entire In the Airplane Over the Sea record in the dark, full of pie. And that was it. That was the beginning of the Dresden Dolls. Good story, right?
And so how did it feel being a force with him, as opposed to what you've now experienced more on your own?
Really powerful. Because I had played enough solo piano shows to know kind of what it felt like to be a chick singer at a piano. And there was only so much you could do. But with the addition of the drums and another human being, and also the concept of being in a band as opposed to solo musician Amanda Palmer, chick at a piano. You know, a band is like a posse. And when you, even if there's only two people in the band, it doesn't matter. You're like a gang. And you have a kind of credibility and an ability to move through the world as a band that you don't have as a solo performer. And I felt that way early on. It wasn't just sonic power. It was like being in a band. And I feel that now with the band I'm touring with. Like, we played in Brisbane last night. And the hour and a half before the show was like one of the greatest little spans of time I've spent in months. You know, I I felt like I was hanging out with my best friends, and Thor was playing inappropriate funk music, and, you know, I wanted to show the band a Russell Brand YouTube clip, and then Jarek had met Robert Forster from the Go-Betweens, and he came backstage, and everybody chatted, and we did shots, and we did each other's makeup, and I was like, this is kind of what you dream about when you're 15 and you want to be in a band. This is what you think it's going to be like. And it's happening. And when I've toured solo, and I had that moment last night where I closed my eyes and took that psychic trip to what would be happening in that moment if I didn't have my band with me. And I just saw myself sitting at the dressing room table, answering email, eating hummus. And I was like, yeah, that's boring. Being with people is fun. But Brian and the band, and being Amanda and Brian and the Dresden Dolls, made so many things possible that just wouldn't have been possible. There is also, you know, if I had recorded all the songs that were on that first album, like Coin Operated Boy and Girl Anachronism and Half Jack and everything, if those had just been recorded as solo piano songs, they would have felt very powerful to me. But I don't know if anyone else really would have given a shit as much as they did with the drums there to create a very credible, this sounds like music framework that the piano alone just doesn't do. And I've learned this about, like, listening to, you know, at one end you've got solo piano, like a songwriter's instrument, and on the other hand you have the ultimate in, you know, production and palatability, like Lady Gaga or Katy Perry. And, you know, you can imagine someone like Lady Gaga making the deliberate decision to just be a chick at a piano and knowing exactly what the limitations are of being a chick at a piano, and then knowing what becomes possible when you make music that people can dance to and music that gets played on the radio. And one thing, I was actually talking about it with my band today in the airport. There's something, like, almost self-selecting about the fact that I never wanted to make music that people could dance to. Or not that I have anything against dancing, but I never listened to the songs that I wrote because I've written some catchy songs. And I never wanted to mainstream them out or make them palatable, I think mostly because I didn't want the kind of lifestyle that I knew was going to go with that. Mm. I wanted to stay in, you know, art fag world, where all my friends were.
Yeah.
So, and it's funny, it was never a deliberate decision. Although when I look back, and I look back at, like, our early days on Roadrunner Records, I realized that other people around me were thinking that, but it didn't even occur to me that that was a good idea in any way, to try and take our music and sort of make it sound like the kind of shit that you would hear on the radio. But it's amazing to me what you can do with a song. I mean, you can pretty much take any song and strip it down and make it very poignant and spare, or you can max it out. And just the production of the song sort of defines who you become and what kind of career you have, which is really crazy when you think about it. And since the Dresden Dolls were just a drums and piano duo, it never occurred to me that that would sort of give us some degree of limitation or freedom. We just knew we were happy with the music we were making, and that was clearly enough.
Mm. I feel like even if you wanted to just be a woman at piano, you never could be. You have this huge community of fans that even when you don't have a band, seem to create one for you.
Yeah.
That's true.
What's one of your favourite stories from interacting with a fan?
I have a really good one from the other day. Most of you probably know about my Kickstarter, but if you don't know about it, I crowdfunded my last record. And there were a bunch of different packages that you could buy, starting with just like the simple CD and the vinyl, way up to $5,000 for a house party, which I'm currently touring and doing, and some of you might even be coming to. And the highest amount of money you can charge for something on Kickstarter is $10,000. And I thought, oh, I've got to have something for $10,000 just in case anyone's crazy enough to want to spend that much money, but what could I offer that would be that valuable? And so I came up with the idea that the $10,000 package would come with everything possible, and an art sitting with me, which means either you could paint me if you wanted to, or I would paint you. You choose. Naked if you want. Either way. That's the way I phrased it, I think. I'll have to go back and look. I'm not even sure I said that. I think with me, it just kind of goes without saying. So I sold two of them, and I've just delivered the second one. The first one was great. It was in Washington, D.C. And this woman bought it, and I phoned her, and I said, so what do you want to do? We're going to get together in a week. I'm coming down to D.C. And she said, well, I don't know. I said, okay, well, let's talk about it. You know, what's happening in your life? She lives with her husband, and she's got a 3-year-old and is pregnant. And I said, well, you know, I think Neil's going to be with me. So why don't... Because she was like, I'm not sure I want to be drawn. I said, okay, well, you don't have to be drawn. You don't have to draw me. Why don't Neil and I come over to your house and paint your kids a mural? And she was like, that sounds great. So we did. We went to her house, and we spent the afternoon at her house painting this giant mural in her unborn baby's room. And it was beautiful. And then, you know, we went out for Indian food. It was great. And the one a few days ago, I did in Perth. And the girl who bought it, I recognized her handle from Twitter, and I knew I must have met her, but I just couldn't match the face with the name. Her name is Yana. And I phoned her from L.A., about a week beforehand, and I said, what do you want to do? She said, I know exactly what I want to do. I was like, okay. What do you want to do? She's like, I want you to paint me. What do we need? I said, okay, we'll get some canvas, or, you know, get some big watercolor paper. I gave her a list of stuff to get, because I'm an amateur artist, but I'm not terrible. And then we arranged that she would come pick me up, and we'd spend the day together. And I don't think she would mind me telling you guys any of this at all. I met her at the gig the night before, I ran into her the day before and finally made the connection. It's like, oh, it's you. You brought me food the last time I was in Perth, you and your brother. It's like, yeah. And she has a form of dwarfism, which means that she's about probably 4 feet tall. She's beautiful, and she wanted me to paint her naked in the park next to the house she grew up in, where she still lives with her folks. And so I went over. Her family were amazing. Her parents were like incredibly cool, kind people. Her mom is French. Her dad is British. Her brother came over. We ate this feast. We drank champagne. We had cake. We had apple pie, actually. It's a theme.
It's a circle.
And then we went off to the park, and Yana shared with me the whole story of what was happening in her life when the Kickstarter launched, and she had lost a friend of hers, and all of these dots connected, and she wanted to give this gift to herself and also kind of as a way of saying goodbye to her friend. And I felt, and she was so cool, and I felt so honored to just be in this position that someone trusted me enough to, you know, having spent very little time with me, having had the connection as a listener to the music, that we could have this day in her house, go out to a park, and she stripped down and I spent 2 hours painting her while she told me about her life. Mm-hmm. And it's in moments like that. I know that if I feel really guilty about making money doing something, I'm usually doing it right. It's like, I can't believe I'm being paid for this. Like, this is the sort of experience that money can't buy. I was so happy. And so was she. We were so happy with each other. And the picture came out pretty good. but it's funny, like, especially when the Kickstarter happened, I sat down with a lot of journalists like this who don't know me and were like, so tell us about this special connection you've got with your fans. And I was like, I don't know if I can explain it to you, dude, at Forbes magazine in 10 minutes. I think it's bigger than something I can explain. And a story like that maybe explains a little bit, but it's, I saw someone write something, a blog, there's a novelist, and his name is escaping me, but he posted a blog today, I tweeted it, and he said something about how he had, I think he had crowdsourced his book, and he's doing very well, and he said that I was an inspiration to him because what he saw from afar of me and my audience is that they weren't even fans. They were basically my friends. And I thought, that's kind of true. It's a dangerous thing to say because, you know, if you all came up to me right now and said, hey, can I have 20 bucks? I don't think I'd say yes to all of you, which is usually how I define a friend. and I have boundaries, yeah, clearly, because you got to. It's not healthy to have 900,000 friends. You shouldn't have 900,000 friends. That's also why, like, the being friends on Facebook kind of creeps me out. It's like, I don't think you have 4,000 friends. Or like, you should have like 5 good friends. And then a bunch of acquaintances and people you get along with, but you don't have space in your life for that kind of energy. It just doesn't work. But the connection is real.
Mm. But that's what strikes me, because the connections you have are so profound sometimes because of the amount of trust that you put in people and the situations that you find yourself in. And yet they're so fleeting. Most of us, when we have a profound experience like that with another person, it's sort of part of an extended relationship. How do you deal with that?
That's a really good question. I think there's two ways of looking at it. One thing that I've noticed is actually really interesting is that I can look at my entire fan base, audience, you know, set of connections with people, and it almost functions like one relationship that you would have with a friend or a lover, and a lot of the same rules apply. And there has to be a give and take, and there has to be communication, and there has to be honesty, and there has to be some degree of explanation if you're going to check out and be out of touch for a while. And you can't just take from it. There has to be a degree of give and take. Otherwise, it doesn't feel like a good relationship. It feels like, you know, you're just there to service your own needs. And all of those rules apply to both, you know, my relationships with my friends and my husband and my relationship with the fan base at large. And in a way, you know, things are fleeting, but they all feel meaningful. And I mean, if I wanted to psychoanalyze myself, I could even say there's a safety to me in the idea that I like get all these incredible goods and then I jet out of town. There's something really fun about that. It's like gazillions of one night stands where, you know, you get kind of all of like the goodies of a relationship, but you don't have to deal with, you know, a phone call the next day that you might not have time for or want to get. And I think as long as you recognize it for what it is, it's okay. Just the same way a one night stand can be fantastic as long as everyone's on the same page about what it means. And in a sense, even if I meet someone in a signing line and I only talk to them for 30 seconds, it feels like it's a connection moment in a history that has already happened and will continue. It's not like that's the end or the beginning. It's like I've kind of been in a long-distance relationship with this person, and now we get to meet each other. And then they're going to go away, and we're going to stay in our long-distance relationship. But it's also why Twitter is so fantastic, because it's kind of like, you know, being able to stay in that constant dialogue with everybody all over the world all the time. So that, you know, I mean, there are people who I've been tweeting back and forth with since I got on Twitter 5 or 6 years ago. And somewhere in there, I mean, I do consider these people kind of friends. I notice them when they're gone. If they don't come to a gig in the city they live in, I wonder where they are. And that's, you know, that's a great function of the internet. It can also be really overwhelming. And sometimes I worry about myself and my kind of like, you know, I feel kind of stuck in my phone. And I wonder if it wouldn't be healthier for me to separate a little bit more and spend more time just by myself making art. But it's funny, I mean, that it says a lot about me as a musician and what kind of musician I am, that I actually don't care if I'm not making music. Because if I'm spending time with people, there's no part of my brain that spent that day with Yana going like, oh man, I could be working on music today. To me, I made music so that I could have that day with her. Which is not the way every musician thinks. But I think, you know, I made music so that I could be with people. I don't be with people so that I can make music. It's kind of... and I don't take for granted that every musician is like me, or every artist is like me. I'm built this way. It took me a while to understand it, but now I think I get it.
You do trust a lot, though, when you allow fans to feed you and to house you. There's a lot of trust involved. And I'm wondering if when that trust is betrayed, if it hurts, do you think it hurts more or less as a result of doing it so often?
What do you mean?
Like trusting. I mean, I would imagine that a regular person doesn't trust people as much as you do on such a regular basis. And do you think the betrayal of that trust hurts more or less?
I think I see what you're saying. I actually found myself thinking about this very question lately, and I came up with it may get a little convoluted, but stay with me. first of all, the trust doesn't get betrayed very often at all, if at all. And it's the great thing about having a pretty tight-knit community is that I just do it without thinking. But occasionally things do happen. And, like, for instance, here's one. I'll give you a couple examples, because they're both good stories. One was I played a ninja gig in London a couple years ago, and it was a totally slapdash, last minute, someone had keys to the bar, let's all go there at midnight, 200 people showed up, there were no rules, it was anarchy, and therefore amazing. And it was in a club, but there were no employees, so there was no security, there was no bartender, it was just madness. And it was a lock-in, so like, and so everyone was everywhere, and we kind of tried to keep the dressing room more or less for the people who were going to be on stage, but, you know, everyone was in and out, and someone stole my ukulele. My precious ukulele, the one that I, you know, bought and started and learned on and had been carrying around in a trumpet case for 3 years. And I realized it at like 4:30 in the morning as we were cleaning up and leaving. And there was no way it was lost. I had taken it off stage, I had put it on the dressing room table, and it was gone. And I thought, fuck, I'm more upset at the fact that someone stole it than I am at the idea of not having it. It's just stuff. But it was such an amazing night, and it was so beautiful, and it was so spontaneous and so trusting that the fact that someone stole my ukulele breaks my heart. And so I tweeted and said, someone stole my ukulele. Everyone knows everyone who was there. There was only 200 people. If anyone knows anything, please tell me. I really, really want it back. And the next day, I got a tweet from someone saying, we know who has it. And I said, send them my phone number, tell them to call me. And they called. And I was staying, at the time I was staying at Imogen Heap's apartment, because she was gone. And this got even weirder, because I was like, now these strange thieves are going to come over to Imogen Heap's apartment to bring me back my ukulele. They'll probably take her apartment. And I told these guys to come over, and at 3 o'clock, the doorbell rings, and there's this boy and girl, probably 17, standing there, holding the ukulele, looking incredibly scared. And I was so proud of them. I was like, I felt like a very, very proud mother. I was like, all right, I'm going to kind of have to scold you, but I'm so proud of you, and I'm so proud of our relationship that you're not afraid of me. Because I, you know, tell me what happened. We were drunk. Of course you were. Come on in. Have some tea. Let me tell you about when I got arrested for shoplifting and why you shouldn't steal.
We need to hear that story as well.
And I sent them on their way, and when something like that happens, the fact that whole story happened, to me, tells you a lot about my fan base, which is the level of trust actually like goes beyond what you can imagine. Even when bad things happen, it's like... So story number two, which is simpler, is I was, you guys may have seen the naked pictures of me getting drawn on by fans at the Kickstarter art parties. One of those nights, I was taking pictures right after being drawn on, which I would do for like 2 minutes, because I definitely felt very weird and vulnerable being totally naked and covered in marker. In a room full of drunk people. But, you know, I'm also very comfortable in my body, and that, you know, it was fine. But one night, there were a couple kind of freaky girls who I had already kind of, I could already tell, like, they were very, very intense and very humorless and very weird. And they posed for a picture with me, and this girl, like, put her hand right up my crotch. And I was like, holy fuck, you're doing that. Don't do that. I know you think that I am very liberated, but, like, the liberation does not include you actually putting your hand on my vagina. Doesn't feel good. I said none of this, of course. This was just my inner monologue. But I felt really kind of grossed out by it, as you would. But I'm also not the kind of person who would make a federal case out of it and be like, everyone stop, I got violated. You know, I just took her hand and removed it and was like, yeah, don't do that. But the thing about trusting people or a fan base or a relationship or anything is that if that risk isn't involved, then it's not trust, if you get what I'm saying. In order to trust someone, there has to be a risk involved. Otherwise, it's just bullshit. It's not trust. It's superficial trust, or it's bullshit trust, or it's, you know, it's not the real thing. And so anytime something like that happens, and I'm going to kind of find myself in the twilight zone, I just appreciate it because it reminds me that the trust is real. Otherwise, it would all be too easy.
Mm. So we've got time for one more question before we'll jump to the audience. You know, it's almost been an hour. It's amazing. You mentioned much earlier Neil Gaiman, your husband, and I imagine one of the issues with being a creative person is that you can't necessarily clock off at 5 p.m. And just, you always have to be open to an idea arriving and having to possibly pursue that idea. You're both creative people in that same boat, I would imagine. How does your relationship work?
I don't know. I wish I had a good answer for that, but, I mean, it's a total... Our relationship is a total improvisation that no one else seems to understand, that we don't even really understand. And we give each other an insane amount of freedom in pretty much every area. And we knew when we started dating each other and then our relationship got serious that the only way it would function is if we pretty much gave each other total autonomous freedom to do what we wanted, make what we wanted, live where we wanted, travel how we wanted, continue to work as artists how we wanted, and somehow find a way to connect with each other while we were continuing to be Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer. And we figured we would just figure it out. And mostly it's fine, but, you know, we hit walls all the time and then we just kind of back up and go, okay, well, what did we do wrong? How did this happen? Why do you feel like this? What do I, you know? And I think, like any relationship, the problems that we have are probably pretty typical. They're just wrapped in a weird, different package of the kind, you know, the sorts of things that happen to two artists who travel constantly and are making work and connecting with gazillions of other people just gives rise to a different set of, like, possible miscommunications and, you know, the sorts of things that show up in any relationship, like jealousy and, you know, misunderstandings and bad communication or whatever. And I don't think our relationship is that different from the relationship of two people who live in a house, who live in a city, who have jobs. But I sometimes measure our marriage in two time spans. One is the actual amount of time we've been married in real person time, which is going on 3 years right now. But then there's the actual amount of time we've spent together, which at this point we've been married in real person years for 3 years, but we've actually only been together for about 6 months. And our relationship grows the most when we're together. And it definitely grows, but at a much slower pace when he's off on tour and I'm on tour, because we don't focus on each other. We focus on the task at hand. He promotes his book or writes his book. I promote my record or make my record or tour with my band. And we stay in touch with each other and we call and we report, but we're not doing the work of a relationship that I see, you know, couples who are having to negotiate every little decision together. Mm. But that also wasn't the kind of relationship I wanted to have. I wanted to have, you know, I wanted to have a partner, but I didn't really want to have a domestic partner. But I also didn't really want to be domestic. So that, you know, that works out fine. But I think our relationship is going to evolve, and hopefully it will evolve, you know, in a way that works for both of us. Is I'd like to slow down and not tour quite so much. I'm getting kind of run down doing it constantly. And, you know, my fear is that it'll be so terrifying for us when we actually have to stop for long enough and like, oh my God, that's who you are? Or shit. like when people's kids leave the house and they all of a sudden have to face each other and they're like, oh my God, it's been 20 years and I actually don't like you. I don't think that's going to happen. We enjoy each other's company a lot. But, you know, if I had an easy answer, I'd be so happy if I had an easy answer to that question. I just don't have one.
All right, one teensy-weensy one. I believe that you're about to write a book.
Yeah.
Is the prospect of writing a book made easier or scarier when you're married to an accomplished author?
Both. There's a pro and a con and in the middle probably. Marrying Neil meant something that I hadn't thought about at all, which was, I've spent time now, a significant amount of time, hanging out in what I call book world. And book world is not like music world or rock world. It is totally different vibe and different set of players and rules and people. And I actually kind of like it. Writers are usually really socially awkward but can be really fun to hang out with. In the sense that I actually have noticed that, like if you asked me, would you rather have dinner with a bunch of rock musicians or a bunch of writers, I would choose the writers, because they do actually really cut through the bullshit and talk about interesting things, depending what kind of writers they are. But I've learned about all sorts of things I just had no clue about publishing and how books work and how they get bought and sold. And this was just stuff that had never occurred to me and that I had never even thought to think about until I met Neil and wound up at writing conventions and, you know, publishers' cocktail parties and stuff. That being said, I kind of know what I'm getting into writing a book, and I'm terrified of being judged by all the book world people, because I don't consider myself a great writer. I consider myself a good sharer, but the writing part kind of gets in the way. I find writing is very boring. And I'd much rather just do this. This to me is easy. I could sit here and talk to you guys for hours. On the other hand, Neil is insanely helpful, and he's smart about the shapes of books and storytelling and how things fit together in a way that is off the charts. And I get to talk to him about my book because I'm married to him, which is a great score for free. He won't charge me. And I know that because he cares about me and is interested in me and will be very happy to help, I will get Neil Gaiman as a, you know, kind of a off-to-the-side editor of my book, or at least someone that I can bounce ideas off and say, like, I'm really struggling, this isn't fitting with this, and his ideas are fucking great. He's Neil Gaiman. So that's a huge positive, and, you know, hopefully balances out the fear I have of, you know, not being a good enough writer. I think there's also something nice about the fact that since I'm predominantly a musician and a performer, and I don't have any desire to transform my life into this next era where I'm going to be Amanda Palmer, the writer, it's okay. My book can be a piece of crap and everyone will be like, oh, she wrote a book, it was okay, but she's a great songwriter. And I'll be okay with that. And I don't think the book will be bad. I think it'll be amazing. I'm going to write a non-fiction book basically about the same sorts of things I talked about in my TED Talk about asking and crowdfunding and life and what I think is happening to artists and musicians right now, and sort of a new era of how we make it work. And Kickstarter just came to Australia, by the way, which makes me very happy. And I hope people, and I mean, I've already seen Possible and people doing great things with crowdfunding in Australia, which is great. But I'm not looking forward to actually sitting down and writing the book. I've always hated and have been really poorly disciplined at writing, and I've dealt with that with my blog for years, which is, I love having my blog and I love having written it, but actually sitting myself down to type it is usually like pulling teeth because there's always something else I'd rather be doing. Having talked to many writers, I'm not alone in that. Most writers hate writing, which makes me feel very not alone.
Well, now it is time, if you have a question, for Amanda to put your hand up. And Paris is somewhere with the microphone. There is a question right here. Is it on?
Yes.
Yes, there it is.
Certainly is.
It's very on.
So your fans have seen you in pretty much every space imaginable, from TED Talks to the Opera House. I know that myself as a fan have been stuck in a photo booth with you and my boyfriend in a tiny gay bar in the middle of Sydney. Is there a space that you would never, ever want fans to be with you or see you in, like something that's just so sacred to you that it would cross over from that relationship?
That's a great question. No one's ever asked me that. And there is an answer, which is, well, I'm sure there's several answers. The bathroom, when I'm going to the bathroom. That just is kind of gross. But to answer you seriously, I practice yoga and have for many, many years. And I've often thought, back in Boston, I've often thought about teaming up with the yoga studio and doing something to do an event there, or do something similar to what I did in Sydney about 4-5 years ago. I was touring here and I was friends with someone who ran a yoga studio in Sydney. So we did a ninja yoga class where I just said, everyone come to the yoga studio. We're going to do a $5 class. Even if you've never done yoga, just come. It's awesome. And I remember someone showed up in jeans and this is a hot yoga class. And I was like, oh, this is going to be a disaster. But every time I've gone down that path of thought in Boston, I've always stopped and gone, you know, I come here and practice yoga all the time, and I love being unknown here. You know, and people know me, the teachers know me, a few, you know, I have a few friends in the class, but I love that I walk in that room and there's just no Amanda Palmer energy. It's so nice. And so I've avoided ever doing an event there because I didn't want to infect it with, even with the indirect, like, oh, that's the chick who's the rock star who did the thing here. You know, I just really like being anonymous, especially when I'm focusing on something like yoga, which is just about getting, you know, getting into a clear headspace. So there are things like that. And, you know, I really love the level of fame that I have. This is a duplicate of a conversation I had in the airport today with Thor, my drummer, because we were talking about this. I decided to wear a crazy suit on the plane today. Jarek and I made this, my bassist and I made this agreement with each other that he would wear his tuxedo on the plane to Brisbane if I wore my shocking lime green suit and hat for fun. And you know, when you wear crazy fancy clothes at the airport, people look at you. Because they do. And we were sitting around musing about how it must truly suck to be a real celebrity, where every time you walk into a room, you're like a bowling ball and all the energy just, and you just fuck up the room. And, or you change it considerably. And I said, you know, like, just as an example, we had all managed to get into the Qantas lounge, which was great, and two of us had to sneak in. Sorry, Qantas. And one person in the Qantas lounge, this woman who was probably in her 50s, came up to me when I was getting a coffee and said, "I love your music." And I said, "Oh, great. Where are you going? Where are you coming from?" She said, "I'm going to Sydney." I said, "Do you know we have a show in town tomorrow?" She said, "No. Where are you playing?" I said, "At the Enmore." It's great. I'll go tell my husband. We'll be there. And that was it. And we were chatting, and I was like, you know, that's perfect. It's like your little wonderful, like, ego food of the moment, and it's fantastic. But you never feel like you're changing the room. And Neil has actually gotten so famous lately that he's veering into that territory of his famousness getting in the way of having a good time. And when your famousness gets in the way of having a good time, it blows. And you couldn't give me anything to be like a crazy celebrity pop star. I wouldn't have any of this. I wouldn't have any of the stuff that I like. I'd have to forsake it. And I'd be forsaking it for something that I don't want or need. So I feel very blessed to be right where I'm at.
Any other questions?
Hey, Amanda. Oh,
hi.
Get back. Yeah, I can agree with what you say. Nicole Kidman, I think, just got knocked over by a paparazzo on a bicycle today. So, yeah, not good. I just wanted to... by the way, I always found it very amusing when I heard that you married a guy called Gay Man. I thought, of course. but
it's Gay Man, actually.
Yes, I know.
I once wrote a song about it called "Don't Call Me Fucking Gay Man."
It's pretty funny. I think we should hear that later.
If I could remember it, I'd play it for you.
Yeah. Anyhow, what I want to ask you... Yeah, nobody's mentioned that before. I can't believe that. Anyhow, I just thought... you've been to Australia quite a number of times, says Neil, so I assume you like us or something.
I like you.
Yeah, okay. Now, Australia, it was a bit like, I imagine, in America, we had the Midwest sort of wide-eyed artist who wanted to make it big, have to go to New York or LA or something like that. And we had a thing called the cultural cringe, particularly back in the 40s or 50s, where you haven't heard of that either. Well, our artists have to go overseas, particularly to America or usually to Britain, to try and make it because we were so cut off from the rest of the world. Now, obviously things have changed and we're doing all right, you know, in the artistic world. But I'm just wondering, because you're a very wise, perceptive kind of woman, and Neil and you might have talked about this, what do you sense is the nature of the creative energy of Australia as opposed to maybe other places? And maybe does it have a sense of having been hothoused away from everything? Or I'm just interested in what your view is.
That's a fantastic question. I think I have my own prejudices about Australia because I love it here, and I think I got ushered into Australia in a couple of really comfortable ways. One was when the Dresden Dolls were on a label, we put our first record out and we came over here and were embraced in a way that no other territory embraced us. And it could have been, I mean, it really could have come down to just a few coincidences of the right people at Triple J hearing the record and deciding to play it a lot, and everyone in Australia just going along with it and loving it and discovering it. But whatever happened when we first came over here for tour, it was unlike touring in the States and in Europe. The enthusiasm about the band was just wild. And of course, that made us very happy. And there you get kind of a chicken-egg thing, which is like, well, was it about the country? Was it about the music industry? Was it about radio? Was it about something Australian and something about the Dresden Dolls' music just being perfect for each other? I don't know the answer to that question. But I did feel very lucky. And then a second thing happened. Because there are other little territories in the world, like Austria and the UK, where the band also kind of exploded, and I've stayed really big as a solo artist. But I started going to the Edinburgh Fringe in about 2006 or 7. And to me, the Edinburgh Fringe is like paradise on earth. It is an entire city transformed into venues for theater and street performance and music, and everybody in my kind of art world all convenes there, and it is amazing. And I naturally gravitated to the Spiegel Tent in Edinburgh because that's where the cool bands and the cool people all seemed to be performing and hanging out. And as it turns out, it was run by a bunch of Australians from Melbourne. And there was a Melbourne-Edinburgh bridge that would basically flip back and forth. All these Melbourne performers were going to Edinburgh every summer. And then a lot of Edinburgh people were going over with the tent back to Melbourne, and they were sort of cross-pollinating. And so I found a group of friends who were centered in Melbourne. Meow Meow and Tom Dickens and Michelangelo and all these great soulful performers, and without meaning to, I all of a sudden had a little family in Melbourne. And that was, you know, that was a coincidence as well. It might have been Sydney or it might have been Cape Town. I mean, it could have been anywhere, but it was here. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think the energy, the artistic energy in Australia, for whatever it is right up my fucking alley, because people are not afraid to be emotional in their art. And there's an authenticity about it that's sincere that I don't feel as much in the States. Which isn't to say there aren't great fucking musicians in the States. They're amazing ones, and some of my best friends are musicians from the States. But there is I see a running theme in certain performers and bands and theater makers in Australia where they're just less afraid to feel. And when I kind of felt that and discovered it, I just wanted to be there and be with it. It also could just be all in my head. Or it could be that, you know, I think these things are, you get very, you can get very tripped up when you generalize, because one thing leads to another, and all of a sudden, you know, my filter and the perspective that I have is, you know, that Australia is very special to me now, and I love Sydney and I love Melbourne, and, you know, I come here like very optimistically craving joy and not probably not wanting to see the negative stuff. Whereas when I go home to Boston, I'm like, oh man, fuck this place. And your attitude changes everything, clearly. So I'm sure that if I were a Melburnian traveling to Boston and had met some really cool fucking people from Boston and wanted to try something new, and, you know, you can create anything anywhere. But at a certain point, you also just have to close your eyes and pick it and go and stop questioning it, because you could drive yourself crazy, which I do. But thank you for that question. It was great.
Oh, there's so many hands. We are almost just about out of time. We've probably got time for one more and then maybe some music, if that's all right.
Hi, so you've just talked about Edinburgh Fringe Festival and all the, you know, amazing performance that goes over there, which is, for me, like, my dream. And I just wondered... I'm over here.
Where are
Hello.
You?
Hello.
He's a dark form.
Oh, there you are, okay.
Yep.
Nice
you.
Shirt.
There Thank you. I love this shirt. I was just wondering, as a circus performer asking a musician, what are your plans for the future in terms of collaboration? Because you're such an amazing collaborative artist and you've moved so many different
places. Repositioning? I have some news brewing that I'm kind of... It's so embryonic that I'm a little afraid to talk about it. But if things go according to plan, about a year from now, I'm going to start working on a musical. But not like a jazz hands musical, like a fucked up weird piece of theater with music in it that may wind up having traditional musical format or not. And I'm going to be creating it with my director hero, Stephen Bogart, who was my drama teacher in high school and who then left teaching high school and directed me in cabaret back in Boston a couple years ago, and who workshopped and directed the Neutral Milk Hotel play that I did with my old high school a couple years ago. And he's a genius. And this is a project that we've been wanting to do together for years and years and years, and it looks like it might finally be time. That's one thing that I've got coming up, and I have a bunch of musicians. I have got like a laundry list of musicians that I've wanted to collaborate with and make music with, that I kind of like almost like a bucket list I want to start knocking off over the next couple years. But those, you know, those projects usually get backburnered and take a lower priority over getting my own music out. So, you know, they get put off and put off and put off. But one of the people on this list is my dad. My dad and I have talked for years about doing a recording collaboration where we cover a bunch of our favorite songs together, because my dad is a fantastic singer. So there's a little list for you.
Well, that's all we have time for with questions. I'm very, very sorry. But maybe you can tweet to Amanda later and she may find time to tweet back. Please stick around for the free jazz a little bit later on. And if you missed anything while you were sitting there or would like to relive the entire night, it will be podcast on 2SER. Just keep checking 2SER.com. And
come to the Enmore tomorrow.
Come to the Enmore tomorrow.
If you're not already.
And I believe you mentioned briefly, if you can't make it to the Enmore, maybe Sydney Festival?
Yeah, Sydney Festival will be officially announced very soon, but it's going to be... So I'll be back in January.
Keep it secret until then.
In the tent. Yeah.
Now, if you'll oblige, it would be lovely to hear some music.
Okay.
If possible.
Yeah, let me grab the ukulele.
Is there anything burning, or would you like to...
What kind of mood are you guys in?
Rowdy.
Rowdy? I have a really embarrassing question to ask, too, which is, does anybody have a guitar pick? There's usually someone with a guitar pick. Usually some cute boy. Thanks.
Look around on the floor.
It should be fine.
There's someone coming. My goodness.
Ooh, I get to pick. I need the thinnest one. This will work. Rowdy. I don't want to ruin any surprises for tomorrow, but I haven't really been playing the ukulele at all at these shows, because why the fuck would I have a rock band? Well, why don't we start with a sing-along? Scream-along. Oh my God. Oh my God. They don't play the song on the radio. They don't show the tits on the video. They don't know that we are the media. They don't know that we start the mania. Your eyes don't want to see what I'm making you. Ass off its seat and I'm shaking you. Walking down the street, I'm the lady. Oh, showing off my map of Tasmania. Oh my God. Showing off my map of Tasmania. Oh my God. Showing off my map of Tasmania. Soft and sweet and shaped like a triangle. Some girls want no shape and they shave it all. That's so whack it hurts with the stubble. Walking around and look like an 8-year-old. I say grow that shit like a jungle. Give him something strong to hold on to. Let it fly in the open wind. If you get too bushy you can trim. They don't play the song on the radio. They don't show the tits on the video. They don't know that we start the mania. They don't know that we are the media. Yeah, your eyes don't want to see what I'm making you. Ass up its seat and I'm shaking you. Walking down the street, I'm the lady. Oh, showing off my map of Tasmania. Oh, oh, my God. Showing off my map of Tasmania. Oh, my God. Showing off my map of Tasmania. Oh, my God. Showing off my map of Tasmania. Oh, my God. Showing off my map of Tasmania.
Thank you.
Does anyone have any requests? In my mind. Easy. Okay. This was actually written right outside of Sydney. I don't mean to like seem like it's such a yoga-centric person, but I was at a yoga retreat outside of Sydney. I forget the name of the town. I used to know it, but it was far away. It was like an hour and a half drive. And I wrote this song like the second or the third day there and played it for the people there and figured I would never play it again because it was so embarrassing. But I kept playing it. Shitty out of tune, hold on. That's close enough. Is it close enough? my mind. In a future 5 years from now, I'm 120 pounds, and I never get hung over, because I will be the picture of discipline, never minding what state I'm in. And I will be someone I admire. And it's funny how I imagined that I would be that person now, but it does not seem to have happened. Maybe I've just forgotten how to see that I'm not exactly the person that I thought I'd be. And in my mind, in the far away here and now, I've become in control somehow, and I never lose my wallet, because I will be the picture of discipline, never fucking up anything, and I'll be a good defensive driver. And it's funny how I imagined that I would be that person now, but it does not seem to have happened. Maybe I've just forgotten how to see that I'm not exactly the person that I want to be. And in my mind, when I'm old, I am beautiful, planting tulips and vegetables, which I will mindfully watch over. Not like me now, I'm so busy with everything that I don't look at anything. But I'm sure I'll look when I am older. And it's funny how I imagined that I would be that person now, but that's not what I want. If that's what I wanted, then I'd be giving up somehow. How strange to see that I don't want to be the person that I want to be. And in my mind, I imagine so many things, things that aren't really happening. And when they put me in the ground, I'll start pounding the lid, saying I haven't finished yet. I still have a tattoo to get that says I'm living in the moment. And it's funny how I imagine that I would win this winless fight, but maybe it really isn't funny that I've been fighting all my life. But maybe I have to think it's funny if I want to live before I die. And maybe it's funniest of all to think I'll die before I actually see that I am exactly the person that I want to be. I am exactly the person that I want to be.
Thanks.
You know, there's a piano, but I feel no particular desire to play it, unless someone's got a song that they really want to hear. Astronaut. I could do that. I'm gonna play it at the show tomorrow. You're gonna get it anyway. Let's see. nice piano. Oh, we're in a jazz club, of course. Everyone around you wants to look. Is it enough to have some love? Small enough to fit inside the cracks. The pieces don't fit. The pieces don't put together so good. The breaking and all the going back, and I am still not getting what I want. I want to touch the back of your right arm, and I wish you could remind me why it was, because every day I'm a little further up. But you are my love, the astronaut flying in the face of sand. I will gladly stay an afterthought. Just bring back some nice reminder. Is it getting harder to pretend that life goes on without you in the wake? Can you see the means without the end and the random frantic action that we take? And is it getting easy not to care despite the many rings around your name? It isn't funny and it isn't fair. You've traveled all this way and it's the same. But you are my love, the astronaut flying in the face of science. I would gladly stay an afterthought. Just bring back some nice reminder. darkness in the day. And you must know it is a terrifying sight, because you and me are living the same way.
Everyone, please thank the amazing Amanda fucking Palmer.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much to Peter for asking such amazing questions.
Thank you.
For inviting me.
And thank you all. And have a wonderful night and an amazing Sydney Fringe Festival. And keep listening to 2SER.
Stay for the free jazz.
Stay for the free jazz.
I'll see most of you guys tomorrow night, I hope. Bring your dancing shoes.